Internet Talk Radio. Asynchronous times demand asynchronous radio. This is Geek of the Week. We're here with Marshall T. Rose, theorist, implementer, and agent provocateur, as he describes himself. Marshall, welcome to Geek of the Week.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Marshall, you're known for a variety of things, but rather than starting with the subtle issues of protocol implementation, let's shoot a few ducks in a barrel. You're probably best known by some, at least, as the author of ISO-DE, the ISO development environment, and I guess that makes you the world's leading OSI implementer. Why do you like OSI so much?
Well, actually, I think we're shooting fish in a barrel, not ducks in a barrel, but probably neither is politically correct these days. It's true that back in 1986, Dwight Cass and I began a research project on implementing OSI, primarily over the upper layer, or the OSI upper layers, primarily over TCP. And, you know, that gave us a lot of experience in implementing OSI. At the time we started, we were really interested in finding out if the OSI stuff would work, and there certainly appeared to be a lot of promise. Unfortunately, and I think history will bear me out on this, or has already, the market's already shown us, that OSI per se, you know, has generally been a bad idea. The concepts, you know, of vendor-independent computer communications we all like, but when it comes down to the actual details and the way these standards are produced and the resulting technical merit, it's certainly been less than sterling. And, you know, now having implemented a lot of OSI stuff in the 80s, in the 90s, of course, I'm one of the more outspoken critics of OSI, which I imagine must drive the OSI people batty, since I often understand the standards better than they do.
Well, having actually implemented the standards can sometimes give you that insight.
Well, you know, certainly one of the things which is the strength of the Internet process is the fact that we intertwine standardization and implementation experience. And, you know, the way the current standards track works now, going from proposed to draft to full, there is an increasing burden on the part of the proponents of a specification to be able to demonstrate independent implementation, interoperable deployment, and so on. So by the time you finally reach, you know, the ultimate goal of having a full Internet standard, you know, we have excellent confidence in the workability and usefulness of this technology, and clearly that's something which has, you know, been lacking from the OSI process.
Well, why is that? Why is something so simple as let's get some code out there and see if it works missing from such a large scale process?
Well, there's the polite answer, and then there's the accurate answer. The polite answer, of course, is that you know, by and large, the ISO, the CCITT, the ITU, ANSI, the IEEE have kind of been overtaken by events. In the past, you saw international and national standardization of very well-defined technologies. For example, if you were going to build nuts and bolts, what the threads look like, and, you know, with the proper spacing and height and grip and so on. And so, you know, this is not rocket science. It's critically important to an engineer's infrastructure to have standardization of these things, but it's not as if we are trying to somehow codify the laws of physics. Now, in contrast, you look at computer communications, and what do you find? You know, this is extremely complicated stuff. It's none of it's very obvious. A lot of it is depressingly cutting edge, and yet, you know, the market seems to feel that they need a standardized product. And so in come the bodies which traditionally have done this in the international and national arenas, and they find out that they aren't standardizing existing technology, which in the past has been exactly what they did and why they were successful. No, they are doing research concurrently with standardization, but somehow their model for standardization never made this paradigm shift to including this implementation. You know, it's kind of like we could have the Congress of the United States pass a law with regards to time travel, but let's face it, you know, no one has a time travel machine, so what's the point of it? You can't change physical laws by making administrative policy. Why should you think you can standardize complicated technology without understanding it?
Well, some would argue that if you try to understand it first, you end up with a process which is not fair. And many people point to the ISO process or the CCITT process, and they say, well, we really have to make standards that are fair, that take into account all the views. Do you think that is maybe the reason that ISO has been continuing to move along that track?
Well, certainly every disaster in history has been very fair in penalizing the victims, hasn't it? No, let's be honest here. What we need to do is we need to produce solutions for the marketplace. And, you know, having some kind of a process which everyone is happy and gets apple juice and cookies and gets to express their, you know, their regional views and so on may be very fine for, you know, international relations, but frankly, you know, does not go one iota towards producing good technology. You know, Marty Schaffstall of PSI, a person I work for and have a lot of respect for, you know, one time he was giving a talk on his thoughts of standardization, and he says, you know, I'm really in favor of international agreements, but I also know that they don't work all the time. And so the audience is, you know, trying to figure out what Marty's talking about. He says, you know, for example, you know, there were international agreements in place, but we still had, you know, something like the Polish cavalry going up against the German army at the beginning of World War II. And what Marty's pointing out there is that, you know, there is a big difference between getting people together to sign a paper and agree that things are going to happen a certain way and having something in place which is actually going to produce workable results. And, you know, we have to keep in mind here that this is an engineering task. This is not a political task. And trying to solve engineering problems using political disciplines is almost bound to failure because, you know, you simply cannot compromise on what the value of pi or the gravitational constant are. I mean, how can a committee decide these things? These are like constants. You can't compromise a constant. What's the point?
You can have pi 1 and pi 2.
Well, and then
you can have pi profiles.
And pi profiles, and then, of course, we could have various national character sets. And well, I'm sorry, that's another target we needn't go into now.
You know, some people look at that and they say, well, that's being unfair. There are certain things that different bodies do well, and many people point to X400, for example, as one of the success stories of the OSI process. Now, recently there's been a alternative set of standards that have come out of the IETF, known as MIME, Multimedia Messaging for the Internet. Could you compare those two? Do you think X400 is going to continue to gain steam or lose steam, and is MIME going to do something there?
Well, you know, certainly, of all the things OSI has produced, one could point to X400 as being the most successful. On the other hand, that's kind of like saying that World War II was the successful conclusion of the Great Depression. And what I mean by that, of course, is that, yeah, you know, it's been adopted more than the rest of this OSI stuff, but it's still a complete disaster. You know, the technology you need to do store and forward mail is surprisingly simple. And, you know, it's not rocket science. There are some very basic architectural principles, and, you know, you may have to have some bells and whistles from time to time, but this isn't hard stuff. What the X400 people did is they started with a model which is fairly well regarded back in the early 80s, took some technology which had been fairly proven. This is, you know, the stuff that came out of Xerox with regards to data representation on the wire, and they built a mail system around it. And, you know, there one could kind of argue about some of the choices they made, but basically it was kind of an overkill for what you needed. There is just far too much computational complexity to solve what is, in theory, a very simple problem. Now, unfortunately, after the great success of 84, Instead of revisiting it and deciding how to make it simpler and more ubiquitous, they go on to the 88 version, and they don't even bother to figure out how to standardize migratory or transition paths between 84 and 88. It's kind of like, oh, let's just do this thing in 88, and we'll forget about the past, whether it was good or bad. Now, what the MIME approach does in contrast is the MIME says, let us assume that we have an existing electronic mail infrastructure, and now we are going to figure out the minimalist set of changes which we can add on top of that so as not to perturb the existing infrastructure, but still add these features to individual endpoints that want them. So if you look at, you know, the MIME spec, you notice there are some rules which really seem rather obscure. You know, do not do the following thing. And then there'll be a little note saying, The reason this rule is here is because we found in practice there is some mail software which behaves poorly under the following conditions, and we want to make sure that when you write MIME software, you don't exercise those problems. Now, you could say, well, you know, this shouldn't be the point of a standard, shouldn't have stuff like that in it. We should just assume that everything works well and people are going to faithfully implement this stuff. But, you know, again, in the real world, we see that's not the case. And the people who did MIME were very, very careful to make sure that the stuff they did would fit on top of and not exacerbate existing problems. Whereas, you know, you compare that to X400, there's just kind of this blanket assumption that someday everything will be X400 and we really don't have to worry about existing mail systems or what the effect we're going to have. And, of course, the result of that is that we see now a lot of, you know, X400 to, you know, such and such gateways, and those gateways really don't work very well because the feature match between X400 and, say, that the LAN mail system that they're gatewaying to is a very poor match. You know, the mappings are imprecise. You know, basically addresses are just hopelessly indecipherable, and it's a big mess.
Well, there you have it.
You're listening to Geek of the Week. Support for this program is provided by O'Reilly & Associates, recognized worldwide for definitive books on the Internet, Unix, the X-Window system, and other technical topics. Additional support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems. Sun, the network is the computer. This is the Incidental Tourist, non-technical reports from out-of-the-way places.
I went to Prague for the 14th Rite meeting, not expecting an Epicurean experience. Visions of cabbage, potatoes, and yet more cabbage danced in my head. While it is true that you dine on lots of cabbage in Prague, the last 2 years have sparked a renaissance of restaurants. You do have to pick carefully, though. Take the Davitska area, home of the Czech Technical University. The plush Obara restaurant on Davitska Circle featured baked boar and beer, which turned out to be a couple of small chunks of pot roast in a gloppy sauce. Cow? I inquired of the waiter. No, forrestig, he insisted. I finished my cow, washing it down with a Pilsner Urquell in a cracked mug. While my meal at Obara came to $15, expensive by Czech standards, just down the street, you can walk up to a window that opens on the street and get a sausage on a roll for 50 cents, or a bambarak, a delicious deep-fried potato pancake, for only a dime. Some of the restaurants are real finds. The Austria, for example, despite its name, specializes in authentic Bohemian food. For about $10 each, we feasted on a meal from appetizers to dessert, washed down with plenty of Pilsner beer, a delightful, locally bottled vintage wine, and, of course, to round out the night, lots of slivovitz. Appetizers at the Austria include a perfectly prepared dish of sautéed chicken livers with stewed apricots, or traditional Prague ham with whipped cream and horseradish, or a beef consommé with liver dumplings. Save room for those main dishes. The Bohemian platter features a mountain of roast duck, roast pork, smoked pork, white and red cabbages, and three kinds of steamed dumplings to sop up the gravy. For only $4, this dish could easily feed a sumo wrestler. Also great were the potato pancakes stuffed with smoked pork. The Austria is on Stefanikova Street, right near Namyeshi 14 Zina. If you want a really special and pretty expensive treat, we can't recommend enough Uzlate Ruski, the Golden Pear. This gem of an establishment is located on Novi Suyet 3 in a steep, narrow, winding street of cobblestones underneath the magnificent Prague Castle. While all the dishes are impeccable, we highly recommend the duck in honey and almonds or the boar croquettes, wild boar stuffed with cheese and tongue and baked to perfection. Appetizers include a half dozen snail preparations, caviar, or a delicious rich stew of tripe and sausage. Start your meal with an aperitif of becherovka, the traditional local spirit of herbs. One lesson we learned in Prague was how to leave without causing an international incident. When calling the wait over, don't call out, check, check. He will look at you in disdain and reply with a sneer, what do I look like, an Albanian? This is Carl Malamud, the accidental terrorist, for Internet Talk Radio.
Internet Talk Radio, flame of the Internet.
Let's turn our attention instead to network management. You're one of the leading lights in SNMP, and you recently, with three of your colleagues, authored SNMP version 2. Now, that was not without some controversy. In fact, one of your critics described SNMP as a, quote, a dog with fleas, and expressed the hope that it would be a dead dog with fleas. Do we really need a second version? Don't we have good enough network management software today?
Well, I guess there are really a couple issues there. Let's have a little bit of historical context, and then I'll kind of get to your question. SNMP version 1 was developed basically in 1987 and came out of some work that was done by four engineers, one of which was a vendor, and three of which had kind of like operational network management operational responsibilities. And so it was a kind of a very focused, the original technology was a very focused on primarily monitoring gateways. And it became clear that we needed to evolve network management into not only monitoring but control, and not only gateways but all kinds of devices. And so SNMP version 1 was kind of like the evolution from this original technology done by this four engineers, where they had a very, you know, crisp focus on what they wanted to do, to kind of like trying to solve or provide a basis for a solution to a larger problem. Now, SNMP has a number of really good things going for it. However, as you implement things and see other people implement them and manage real networks and, you know, just gain experience, you know, you find things that you could have done better. When the same questions keep coming up or the same requests for features enhancements coming up, you begin to think maybe we shouldn't have left that out of the original spec. And so, you know, 4 years after V1 was standardized, there was a call for proposals from the IESG saying we'd like to evolve SNMP. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to ask interested parties to submit proposals which meet the following list of criteria. And there were, about half a dozen criteria, you know, of which, you know, two of the most important were is you had to spend a lot of time worrying about coexistence with the installed base, because network management and the Internet is a 7x24 pervasive thing. And, you know, also that, you know, you couldn't offer a proprietary solution. It was something that was going to ultimately be standardized by a working group of the IETF. This call came out in March of 1992. Now, several months went by, and finally one proposal was put forth by myself, Jeff Case, Keith McLaughlin, and Steve Waldbusser. And this was called SMP, or the Simple Management Protocol, and basically this was our proposal. There was a meeting held at the July 1992 IETF plenary, which about 200 people showed up. We explained what our proposal was, and there was near unanimous, and I'm not exaggerating here, virtually everyone in the room at the end of that meeting decided that they wanted to go forward with SNMP V2, they wanted V2 to be the work on SNMP security plus this proposal, and that they wanted, you know, a working group formed, and they wanted this thing taken care of by year's end. Because the critical thing is we do not want to get ourselves involved in more than one transition. You know, not a transition from V1 to security and then security to V2, or V1 to SMP and then SMP to something else. One transition, V1 to V2. So a working group is formed, and comments were solicited. Now, in between the time that, you know, there's this meeting in July and the working group formation, the area director, you know, encouraged anyone with proposals, you know, to put them forth so they could also be considered. Well, 3 months goes by, no other proposals show up.
Is that enough time to put a proposal together?
Well, you know, the original call came out in March. Now, one would imagine that if someone really cared about this, one could put a proposal together in a 6-month period. So basically going from March to September. The fact that there weren't any proposals tells me either A, people thought that the existing proposal was good enough, B, they didn't care about it, or C, they just didn't want to do the work. And, you know, I guess the only kind of people I would complain about are the ones who fall into C, where, you know, they don't want to do the work to put the proposal together. So the working group meets, and, you know, there are a lot of discussion, and, you know, I'll tell you quite frankly, the quality of the documents has improved as a result of the working group examining and revising the documents. The problem, of course, is that for every real good improvement we had, you know, there were many suggestions and arguments about things which basically were either technically out of scope of the SNMP V2 charter, or unfortunately were kind of like issues which really hadn't been thought out all that well. And, you know, this is an area where I kind of get a black eye because, you know, I am famous for my lack of tolerance of nonsense. And what I mean by that is that, you know, people asking questions I can deal with, when someone brings up an issue which had been discussed and handily dismissed in the past, they'd better have some new points when they bring up that issue, because I really do not like rehashing the same arguments over and over again. It's kind of like if you're standing on the deck of the Titanic and you see the iceberg, you have two choices. You jump off the port side of the ship or the starboard side of the ship. You don't stand there in the middle of the bow plane deciding which foot you want to lead off with when you jump. It's time to jump. And once you've jumped, you can't say, oh, no, I'm jumping in the wrong direction. You have to go overboard. And so, you know, it's when an issue has been thoroughly discussed, as several of these had in the past, to have them be brought up again in the course of this without any new facts being brought to light, you know, just absolutely infuriates me. And so I tend to lose my temper and let people know what I think of them, and that makes Marshall the ogre of the Internet, you know, for which all I can say is, well, you know what causes me to be an ogre. Perhaps you should try not to exhibit that behavior, which basically causes that kind of a result.
But isn't that the job of a working group, to make sure these issues are properly hashed out?
Well, you know, you'd think that, wouldn't you? But, you know, on the other hand, how many times do you have to hash out the same issue? I don't have any problems with someone saying, we've discussed topic A in the past, and there have been arguments in both directions, but here is something new which we haven't considered. We really need to reopen A. The problem is that never happens. What happens is I want to talk about topic A again. Here's my proposal. And instead of going through and making sure that, you know, that the old arguments have been dealt with, that any new information has been brought up, it's kind of like this is zero memory on the part of the working group, that, you know, that this thing has never been discussed in the past and therefore it's fair game, when in point of fact that the two or three topics which got to this level, which we call tar baby status, you know, are things which had literally been discussed for the last 4 years every 6 months, and every 6 months they go down in flames.
What's an example of one of those issues?
Well, the typical example is the argument as to whether row creation and, or more properly, row manipulation in SNMP is an artifact of protocol operation or MIB design. And that's a very complicated way of expressing the following concept. A lot of times you have management information of which there are multiple instances, so like multiple rows in the routing table. Each row consists to a routing entry. One of the things you have to do in SNMP is have the ability to identify a particular row, and then perhaps you want to create a new routing entry, or you want to modify an existing one, or you want to delete it. Well, modifying things which are existing is a fairly straightforward thing. So also with deleting them. The question comes about, how do you go about creating a new row, say in the routing table or something like this, and do it in such a way that you don't collide with other managers, which also might be controlling the router, and make sure that you have all the information in that entry in the routing table before the router starts to use it, because you may not be able to fit all of the information you need in one packet in just one transaction to make it happen. You may have to do a little negotiation over the creation. And so there's always been kind of this question, or at least this question comes up every 6 months, is, well, do you have a special protocol operation called create row, or when you design the routing table, do you define the semantics of how row creation occur? And, you know, you can argue it either way. The problem is that if you look at all of the conflicting requirements you have, you find out that the protocol solution simply will not work. There are just some cases it can't solve, whereas the solution by MIB design, or defining the semantics of the routing table, can meet all of those requirements, although, you know, at times it may be a little ugly or a little hairy, but at least you can solve the problem. And again, you know, in a lot of cases, you have to go for 100% solution. So, you know, this topic came up in November, and, you know, I just absolutely hit the roof, because, you know, this topic has literally been discussed on a six-month repeating schedule since 1988. And unfortunately, the people who put forth the proposal did not put forth a proposal that, like, had been entirely thought through, did not deal with the arguments which have been brought up in the past time and time again. And, you know, so basically it's kind of like, oh, well, here, we wrote this up, put it in the standard, and I'm sorry, wait, you know, did you realize there are all these problems and like, you can't solve it using the approach you're using? Do you realize we've discussed all this stuff in the past? Why are you doing this now? And, you know, and so then there's this this huge fight, and instead of handling it in the absolute most diplomatic way, sometime, you know, I regrettably just explain to people that their thinking isn't entirely as clear as it ought to be.
This is Geek of the Week, featuring interviews with prominent members of the technical community. Geek of the Week is brought to you by Sun Microsystems and by O'Reilly & Associates. This is BookBite with Dan Dorenberg.
X-Window System Administrator's Guide for X11 Release 4 and Release 5 by Linda Mui and Eric Pierce. Published by O'Reilly & Associates, 346 pages, $29.95. This is the first X-Book wholly devoted to administrators. Aside from the obligatory material on configuring the user environment and XDM, it discusses security, font and color managers, installing X, using X in non-Unix environments, getting public domain software, and many, many other topics. Every X site should have a copy of this book. O'Reilly is also publishing an edition of this book with accompanying CD-ROM. That sells for $49.95. This is Dan Dorenberg for BookBite.
BookBite is brought to you by Computer Literacy Bookshops, world's largest bookstores devoted to computer and electronics books. Internet Talk Radio, town crier to the global village.
You and three of your colleagues went off and invented SNMP version 2, and you did it in a back room. You didn't do it in public. You didn't do it in a working group, and that was kind of unfair because you have a head start over everybody else and that you're rushing the process too much. Do you think we need to slow that process down or involve more people in the design of these things?
Well, to begin with, keep in mind that the four of us did exactly what we were asked to do by the IESG, which was to go off, form a design team, and do this.
Well, you had already started when that call for proposals came out, hadn't you?
Well, I could argue that I had started back in 1988 when I had finished SNMP version 1 as chair of that working group and was making my list of things to fix or things I couldn't get in version 1 that I wanted in version 2. So, I mean, in a sense, if you're saying, you know, you had already started, sure. And I would imagine anyone involved with version 1 had already started the day after version 1 got standardized. But, you know, let's keep in mind here that a call for proposals went out. Anyone was perfectly free to form their own design team and do this. But the only people who basically committed every free second of their time from March until July were the four of us, and we did the work. Now, is that unfair? You know, there are a lot of people who kind of complain that Marshall, or maybe Marshall and Jeff Case, kind of have a stranglehold on network management, that we're profiteers or robber barons or something like that. And I must admit, I do like being compared to a robber baron. There's a lot of kind of old 19th century romance associated with people who own railroads and, you know, and control millions of lives.
Although you're building one, not owning one, but that's okay.
Yeah, but regrettably, it's also not a very factual description of me, except, of course, I do kind of fit the physical caricature, but we won't go into that for now. But I have to learn to smoke cigars, of course, and appreciate fine brandies. Be that as it may, you know, the only reason that Jeff and I exert so much control in the world of SNMP is that Jeff and I, and also Keith and Steve, we simply put in more hours than anyone else. And this is an entirely democratic process. Someone wants to compete head-to-head with Marshall Rose or Jeff Case or Keith McClogger or Steve Walbusser, here's how you do it. You simply match us in quality and quantity of hours. You do that, and you'll be on an equal footing with us. But unless you're willing to make the investment of time and other resources, you know, you should expect to lose arguments. You know, in a lot of these things, in the working group, you know, people brought up proposals which we had thought of ourselves and, you know, and done an analysis of and then figured out one reason or another why it wouldn't work. And then they're surprised why we're against it and why we have all these arguments tailor-made as to why the proposal will fail. Well, gee, guys, we thought of that 6 months ago and decided we couldn't make it happen. So it's you know, in a sense, this is really kind of an unfair thing. Now, you know, I should point out, of course, that the four of us do have an advantage because we do spend all this work, and that's our choice, and certainly people can compete with us. Similarly, you know, Jeff Case, in addition to being at the university, of Tennessee at Knoxville. You know, he is also is also president of S&MP Research, and he sells S&MP products for profit. I have a book called The Simple Book, which is about S&MP, and I'm currently working on the second edition. And certainly, it's very much in my financial interest to have this S&MP V2 stuff finished so I can get the book on the shelves and make another killing. On the other hand, I'll also point out that there are easily 24 vendors participating in the S&MP V2 effort who basically have not done a lick of work in the working group towards adding to the quality of the S&MP V2 proposal, and yet they're going to make a ton of money when they sell S&MP V2 products. So, and they're, of course, interested in having this stuff come out as fast as it can as well. But no, I mean, you know, it's sure, of course I have an interest in this stuff. And in fact, I'll go so far as to say is that the people in the process I just trust the most are the ones who don't have any apparent interest. Because, you know, what's it for them, whether this stuff is good or bad, whether this stuff gets advanced in a timely fashion or not? Those are the people I really worry about. You know,
well,
what if
they represent another segment, another group, another country, another protocol religion? Shouldn't they be in that, or do you think you should just deploy the technology as quickly as possible?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, you can only standardize on stuff that you have. You can only standardize and be successful on technology which works and people are willing to build products to. Certainly we have tried to meet as many of the industry's requirements as we can in producing S&MP V2, and there are some requirements where basically we've just had to say, sorry, you can't have that. And, you know, and in cases like that, basically it comes down to adding that particular feature would have a detrimental effect on the overall operation of the system, and this is an engineering trade-off, and you have to decide whether you want to make things run or whether you want to make sure that everyone has their apple juice and cookies at the end of the day. And I'm sorry, you know, we're here to make the trains run. We're not here to hand out apple juice and cookies.
Well, I can think of another instance where a similar decision was faced by the IAB.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking at the routing and addressing crisis, and they said, we've got a train to run. And they decided, at least on a direction for IP version 7. And the community didn't react nearly as favorable. What is the difference between pushing S&MP V2 out because it needs to be done and pushing, let's say, a connectionless network service out as IPv7?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that the S&MP V2 effort did not get its push until the July meeting of the IETF in Cambridge, when there was, one of the meetings at the plenary where over 200 people showed up, you know, heard the proposal, and then, you know, as a body they said, do this now, make it happen, let's go. Now, from my perspective, when you have 200 people willing to show up at an IETF meeting and sit in the same room and listen for 3 hours to a proposal, and then after some questions and answers, basically have virtually everyone in the room point to exactly the same goal, that's a mandate. In the case of the IPv7 thing, the problem we have is that everyone agrees there's a problem. We disagree as to the extent of the problem, whether it is a clear danger or a present danger, and we certainly disagree on what the solutions are. So there is no clear mandate. And so for the IAB or anybody to say, okay, this is what we're going to do, without having that mandate, they certainly open themselves up to just being in a tremendous pressure cooker, and that's where they found themselves.
Now, the result of that pressure cooker was an effort called POISED, which examined how we govern ourselves in the IETF.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling on what's happened with the POISED efforts? You were one of the authors of the compromise proposal at the IETF, where it was decided to have a random selection committee and a change in the roles of the IAB and the IESG. Have we fixed things? Are we ready to settle down and get back to work?
Well, the outcome of POISED was to try and introduce a level of accountability into the selection process, and basically an advise and consent kind of role between the rank and file and the management structure. And what we came out of that, basically a pool of volunteers randomly selected to make recommendations, which then the management structure can approve or deny, probably is the best compromise that could have been worked. And I think in the long term, it's probably going to serve us very well. I think what we're going to end up seeing is more new blood coming into the system at a time when we really start to need it. You know, one of the problems we had with the old system is kind of being self-selecting. While the quality of the individuals was good, we just didn't have a way of grooming our junior people into becoming senior people. And what my hope is now is that we're going to start getting some of the people who are working group chairs are going to start becoming area directors. People who are area directors are either like going to move on to the IAB or perhaps into some other position, and then new working group chairs will come in. So we'll kind of like start to build up more of a collection of people who have internet management experience. And I think we have to start doing this because, you know, a lot of the people we have now in the senior positions are, for better or worse, are nearing retirement, and they just don't quite have, you know, the energy that they used to. And, you know, furthermore, you know, we have to keep in mind that as we are ever expanding and growing, we have new constituencies. We need to provide an outlet so those new constituencies, you know, feel that they have adequate representation and so on, and that their views are known. Now, having said all that, there are some things that we absolutely must avoid. The thing which we must avoid is any concept of participation via affiliation. That is, oh, I'm the representative from company XYZ, or I represent the European, the Scandinavian portion of the internet, or something
like
that.
But these are the people that are often paying to send these people to the committees, and so IBM pays IBM employees. Shouldn't IBM as a corporation have a voice?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I'd argue that no corporation, nor any organization, have a voice as a part of their corporate entity or identity. No, that's just wrong. I mean, if you do that, you will immediately find yourself devolving into the ISO/ANSI/OIW way of doing things, which would just be absolute disaster. Companies which send people to the IETF do so because they have a financial reason for having people there. Sometimes they have people there for education purposes. Sometimes they have people there to push an agenda. Sometimes they have people there because they view it as a matter of community service. And certainly it's this latter aspect which I would like to encourage, would like to encourage people to kind of view their participation in the IETF is a matter of community service. The fact that you shouldn't view being on the IESG or the IAB as a reward, you should rather review it as 2 years of 2 years of community service. You know, not unlike many countries which require all able-bodied adults to serve in the military from time to time as a reservist or on standby or something like that. We need to view these management positions the same way, and we certainly shouldn't view it as I'm from Corporation XYZ.
Don't touch that mouse. Internet Talk Radio will be right back.
Our acronym du jour is P2C2E, and if you know that one, how about the ever-popular M2C2D?
This is Internet Talk Radio. All material contained in this file is copyright 1993 by Internet Talk Radio. You may copy these files and change the encoding format, but may not alter the content or resell the programs. You can send us mail to mail@radio.com.
Our acronym of the day is the famous P2C2E, a process too complicated to explain. This gem comes from Salman Rushdie's classic fairy tale, Harun and the Sea of Stories. P2C2Es, of course, run on M2C2Ds, machines too complicated to describe.